grasps an existence of frugality and sacrifice to a tipping point where life feels like incarceration. Does this guy's life seem awesome or mediocre? Will it merge with a dream? The slow lane plan forsakes the now for a faint promise of a wealthy future. I don't consider settle for less a strategy, which is why the slow lane is predisposed to mediocrity. Life isn't great, but it isn't so bad either. No, it could be better, but you got to swap the slow lane for a new plan. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. The slow lane is a natural course correction from the sidewalk, evolving from taking responsibility and accountability. Wealth is best experienced when you're young, vibrant, and able, not in the twilight of your life. The slow lane is a plan that takes decades to succeed, often requiring masterful political prowess in a corporate environment. For the slow laner, Saturday and Sunday is the paycheck for Monday through Friday. The default return on your time in the slow lane is a negative 60%, or 5 for 2. The 5 for 2 trade inherent in the slow lane is generally fixed and cannot be manipulated because job standards are 5 days a week. The predisposed destination of the slow lane is mediocrity. Life isn't great, but it isn't so bad either. Chapter 11, The Criminal Trade, Your Job. By working faithfully 8 hours a day, you may eventually get to be the boss and work 12 hours a day. Robert Frost. I spent 5 years in college for a phone book? Before college graduation, I humored myself and attended a few job workshops. I remember one vividly, an entry-level position at a big insurance firm in Chicago. During our introduction at the corporate facility, the company recruiters told us exactly what to expect.
Over there, pointing to a sea of cubicles, is where our new hires sit. I won't be coy. In the beginning, this job is difficult. We give you 3 things, a desk, a telephone, and a telephone book. You will spend 10 hours a day cold calling to build your clientele. I know, not glamorous, but the rewards...
At that point, the rewards were inconsequential, and I went into acting mode. I acted interested. I acted happy. I acted like it was acceptable. It wasn't. I spent 5 years in college just to sit in a 6x6 cubicle and cold call elderly people out of a damn telephone book? Are you freaking kidding me? I could have done this out of middle school, and I didn't need to spend thousands on a college degree to hawk insurance. Yet my peers salivated at the opportunity of having a nice base salary, a great 401k, and a top-tier health plan. No thanks. If I'm cold calling out of the damn phone book, it won't be for my boss, but for me. Jobs, domestication into normalcy. If you want to escape the slow lane, find wealth and freedom fast, you've got to dump the damn job. Let me repeat, dump the job. Jobs suck. I mean that generically, not targeted toward a specific job. Whether you're an electrician or a store manager, you hold a job. Jobs suck because they're rooted in limited leverage and limited control. Sure, you can have a great job, and a fun one too, but in the scope of wealth, they limit both leverage and control. 2 things desperately needed if you want wealth. Here are 6 sucky reasons why your financial plan shouldn't revolve around a job, the nucleus to the slow lane. Suckage number 1. To trade time is to trade life. Who taught us that trading time in exchange for money was a great idea? Why does this normalcy consistently translate into unrivaled suckage? If you're shackled to a job, you're engaged to a glorified exchange of your time, your life, for pieces of paper that grant you freedom. You sell your freedom to get freedom. Pretty stupid, huh? Jobs suck because they ravenously consume time. At a job, time trade is central to how you make money. A job is the basis for that horrific 5 for 2 exchange. But let me translate that word time differently. Life. In a job, you sell your life for money. If you work, you get paid. If you don't work, you don't get paid. Who officiated this blood-sucking marriage? Here's a list of common jobs and how long you have to work just to earn $1 million. If you diligently save 10% of your earnings and stuff it under a mattress, your time to 1 million multiplies by a factor of 10. Architect, 16 years to earn 1 million. Bartender, 61 years to earn 1 million. Carpenter, 27 years to earn 1 million. Secretary, 27 years to earn 1 million. Software engineer, 13 years to earn 1 million. Pharmacist, 11 years to earn 1 million. Physical therapist, 15 years to earn 1 million. Veterinarian, 14 years to earn 1 million. Now, if you save 10% of your earnings, multiply each of those years by 10. That's how long it will take you to save 1 million. So wouldn't it make sense to get paid regardless of what you're doing? Get paid while you sleep, while you have fun, while you poop, while you sit on the beach? Why not get paid with the simple passage of time and make time work for you instead of against you? Does that exist? It does, but it doesn't come from the slow lane. Suckage number 2, limitation on experience. I learned more as an entrepreneur in 2 months than I did working 10 years at dozens of dead-end jobs. The problem with a specialized skill set is it narrows your useful value to a confined set of marketplace needs. You become one of many cogs in a wheel. And if that cog becomes obsolete or expendable, guess what? You're out of luck. For example, thousands of auto workers have been displaced because their jobs have been outsourced or replaced by robotics. Experience doesn't help them, it hinders them. Remember typewriters? How is the typewriter repairman doing these days? How about stockbrokers, travel agents? Dying breeds of jobs move out of favor like fashion fads. One year your skill set has value, the next it doesn't. Second, job experience is usually regimented into a core group of activities that is routinely repeated over and over again, day after day. After the initial learning experience, the job becomes regimented and accumulation of new knowledge creeps to a crawl. A job limits learning and mutates into life's death knell, a trade of life force for money. Experience comes from what you do in life, not from what you do in a job. You don't need a job to get experience. Ask yourself this, which experience is more important? The experience of a menial job designed to pay your bills? Or the experience and failures of creating something that could provide you financial freedom for a lifetime without ever having to hold a job again. Suckage number 3, no control. A job is like sitting in the bed of a pickup truck. You're exposed to the harsh elements while the driver of the truck sits comfortably in the driver's seat. And if the ride gets rough, you get jacked around or worse, tossed overboard. There is no control sitting in the back of a pickup truck, and to have this strategy at the heart of your financial plan is asinine. If you don't control your income, you don't control your financial plan. If you don't control your financial plan, you don't control your freedom. Millions obediently sing the employee kumbaya and believe that a job is central to supporting themselves. Sure, a job can support you, but is your goal only support? Do you want wealth or mediocrity? If the momentum of your financial road trip can be roadblocked by a pink slip, you're gambling. You aren't being real. You're being stupid. There is neither safety nor security in a job. Suckage number 4, Linda's bad breath. I have people in my family who are lifelong employees. I hear their trials and toils. Despite 24 different jobs over the years, I notice nothing changes when it comes to office politics. It's the same story, different people, different day, in a different office. So-and-so is sleeping with the boss and courting favor. Jim is lazy but takes credit for the work. Linda has bad breath and everyone is afraid to tell her. Lacey arrives late and leaves early. Oh, and Horace steals food and wears the same sport jacket every day. Lazy Lester never replaces the copier paper. Same stories, different office. No matter where you work, office politics play a part. The stage is different, but the actors are the same. And unfortunately, as an employee immersed in the work environment, you have to play the game. You have to be obedient or face retribution from coworkers or your boss. I can remember my friend's after-work rants as she toiled a high-carbohydrate corporate environment. Everything had a process. Got an idea? Great, send it to the boss sends it to his boss, who then hands it off to legal, who then sends it back to her boss's boss for revisions, who sends it back, blah, 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 blah. By the time the idea gets anywhere, it's either stale or four other people have staked a claim to it. Who needs this entangled web destroying your sanity? The only defense to office politics is to control the playing field, and to do that, you have to be the boss. And to be the boss, you not only need to run the show, you need to own it. Suckage number 5, a subscription to pay yourself last. Pay yourself first is a slow lane doctrine. The problem is that it's near impossible in a job. Local, state, and federal governments heavily tax earned income, and your options to shield that income from taxation is limited to contributions to 401ks and IRAs, which are also limited. 10% of your income or a maximum of $16,500, whichever is less. If you diligently trade your life and ascend into corporate management, expect 50% of your money to disappear before it touches your hands. As an employee, you immediately receive a subscription to pay yourself last. And yes, that subscription arrives even if you don't subscribe. If you are paying yourself last and everyone gets your money first, don't expect to build wealth fast. Suckage number 6, a dictatorship on income. Ever get hit with a 1,000% pay raise from your boss? Imagine this. Impressed at the obvious returns you've provided at your job, you confidently stroll into your boss's office and demand a raise. I bring value to this company, you argue. I'm reliable and I rarely call in sick. Your boss takes a defensive posture, crosses his arms, tilts his head skyward, and leisurely reclines in his big red executive chair. You take a deep breath and let it ride. Therefore, sir, I'd like a 1,000% pay raise. Your boss emits a guttural groan. He lurches forward, ends his recline, and hammers his hands to the desk. Okay, what's the joke? I'm busy, he snipes. You reply, no joke. I'm serious. I make $9 an hour. I want a raise to $90 an hour. How about this? You'll get nothing and like it. Get out of my office, quit wasting my time, and if you do it fast, I won't fire you. You stammer out. I guess the boss didn't think a 1,000% pay raise was doable. This scenario would never happen. As an employee, you can't demand a raise greater than 10%, let alone 1,000%. Yet, as an employee of a company, this is your playing field. Your value is dictated, and the job becomes a wealth delimiter, with limitations that cannot be subverted. A job seals your fate into a criminal time trade, 5 days of life traded for 2 days of freedom. A job chains you to a set grade of experience. A job takes away your control. A job forces you to work with people you can't stand. A job forces you to get paid last. A job imposes a dictatorship on your income. These limitations are counterinsurgencies to wealth. Do you still want a job? Chapter summary, fast lane distinctions. In a job, you sell your freedom in the form of time for freedom in the form of money. Experience is gained in action. The environment of that action is irrelevant. Wealth accumulation is thwarted when you don't control your primary income source. Chapter 12, The Slow Lane, Why You Aren't Rich. Somebody should tell us right at the start of our lives that we are dying, that we might live life to the limit every minute of every day. Do it, I say. Whatever you want to do, do it now. There are only so many tomorrows. Michael Landon. Exposing Slow Lane Ineptitude. If the slow lane is your get-rich strategy, I can make a likely assumption. You're not rich, and you will never be. Wow, how could I be so sure? Simple. The slow lane strategy is rooted in uncontrollable limited leverage, or ULL, pronounced Yule. If you need help remembering this important concept, just think, if the slow lane is your plan, you'll never get rich. Uncontrollable limited leverage is the disturbing evidence that proves the slow lane's futility. How do you get rich in the slow lane? You get a great paying job, you save money, live frugal, invest in the stock market, and repeat for 50 years. If you mine this strategy into its mathematical constructs, you will find the variables that define the plan cannot be controlled and cannot be leveraged. Uncontrollable Limited Leverage, ULL, Part 1. Why is ULL so important? To attract financial wealth, you need to attract large sums of money. To attract large sums of money, you need two things. Number one, control, and number two, leverage. The slow lane has neither, and that truth is exposed when you reverse engineer the strategy into its mathematical equivalent or its wealth universe. Uncover the mathematics behind the plan, and you uncover its weakness. When the slow lane is deconstructed, you'll find two variables. Number one, the primary income source, which defines how income is earned, and number two, the wealth accelerator, which defines how wealth is accumulated. The slow laner's primary income source comes from a job, while the wealth acceleration vehicle comes from market investments like 401ks and mutual funds. Put it together and you arrive at the slow laner's wealth equation. Wealth equals job, the primary income source, plus market investments, the wealth accelerator. Under this plan, income from a job funds both lifestyle and market investments. However, to uncover the prohibitive ULL within this plan, we have to factor these variables further, starting with the job variable. The warden of wealth, intrinsic value. How is money earned in a job? Intrinsic value. Intrinsic value is determined by the marketplace, and it is the price at which you can trade your time for money. Intrinsic value is what you earn working a job. How much is someone willing to pay you for what you have to offer to society? Intrinsic value is measured in units of time, either hourly or annually. If you're paid $10 an hour to flip burgers at the neighborhood grill, your intrinsic value is $10 an hour. If you're a lawyer and earn $120,000 annual salary, your intrinsic value is $120,000 per year. The formulas. Job or intrinsic value equals hourly rate of pay times hours worked. Or job, your intrinsic value, equals annual salary. Notice that intrinsic value is measured in units of time. This time attachment introduces the slow lane's first punitive element of wealth creation. Can you control time? Can you leverage time? You can't. Your time is limited to 24 hours of exchange. If you earn $200 an hour, you can't miraculously demand to work 400 hours in one day. If you earn $50,000 a year, you can't miraculously demand to work 400 years in your life. Time has no leverage. For the hourly worker, your maximum upper limit is 24 hours, and guess what? There's nothing you can do to change it. In theory, you can trade 24 hours of your day for income, but you can't trade more. Of course, working 24 hours a day is impossible, so 8 to 12 hours per day are usually traded. For the salaried worker, the prohibition is the same. You can't work more years than your normal life expectancy. What is the upper limit of this exchange? 40, 50 years? In all of recorded history, no human has ever worked 10,000 years of his life. Whether you're paid hourly or annually, it doesn't matter. You cannot leverage time. Consider this. Is 12 a large number or 50? Are these numbers predisposed to create millionaires? They aren't, and it exposes why the mathematics of a job are wealth punitive. Your time is limited to small numbers and can't be leveraged. Hours worked or annual salary are mathematically inept because they're based on time measurements which cannot be controlled or manipulated. Mathematics doesn't lie. 12 will always be less than 10 million. If leverage is limited, so is wealth creation. Small numbers do not make millionaires. Behind limited leverage is another corrosive wealth killer. No control. Can you control your employer? Can you control your salary? Can you control the economy? Can you earn $50,000 one year and next year bank $50 million? Can you control anything about your job, including your measly 4% pay raise? You might think you can by job hopping, but you can't. Control is weak, if not absent. Compound interest, what they don't tell you. The second variable in the slow lane wealth equation is the primary wealth accelerator, which comes from market investments like mutual funds, 401ks, and other traditional investments touted by gurus and financial advisors. These investments use the financial strategy known as compound interest, which is a mathematical construct that outlines the power of interest accumulation over great periods of time. The fundamental cell of compound interest is the old guru swan song, regurgitated ad nauseum.
$10,000 invested today will be worth gazillions in 40 years. Invest $250 a month for 50 years and you will retire rich.
Used correctly, compound interest is a powerful ally to wealth. Used for slow lane purposes, and it dredges the wealth road trip to a crawl. Why? Again, the puzzle is solved if you exploit the math. The answer plays sibling to why a job won't make you rich. Time. Wealth creation via compound interest requires the passing of time, and lots of it. Like a job, compound interest or market investments such as mutual funds and 401ks cannot be leveraged, or can they be controlled. They rely on deficient math to create wealth. Inasmuch as the income you make in a job is measured in an hourly rate or an annual salary, the wealth acceleration process of compound interest is also measured in time, or years, multiplied by a yearly yield. Let's again review the physics, the mathematical formula for the slow lane pathology to wealth. Wealth equals job, the primary income source, plus market investments, the wealth accelerator. This equation, factored, equals wealth equals intrinsic value plus compound interest. Factored further, wealth equals time times hourly or salaried value plus invested sum times parentheses 1 plus yield to the square root of time. Like a job, the flaw in compound interest lies in the same mathematical restrictions in which numbers work against you instead of for you. Take a listen to this chart, which highlights the effect of compound interest and that $10,000 investment.
For a $10,000 investment, after 40 years at 10% growth, you will have $452,000. $10,000 invested at a rate of growth of 15% will be worth $2.6 million at the end of 40 years.
Now, a slow lane guru preaches that a $10,000 investment grown at 15% will be worth over $2.5 million in 40 years. Hooray! What don't they tell you? They don't tell you that a 15% return year after year is impossible unless you invest with the likes of Bernie Madoff or Charles Ponzi. They don't tell you that in 40 years, you'll likely be dead, and if you're not, you'll be close. They don't tell you that in 40 years, your $2.5 million will likely be worth $250,000 in today's dollars, and that a gallon of milk will cost $12. They don't tell you that this method of wealth acceleration is not what they use. They don't tell you plenty, and yet you're supposed to believe it without question. Uncontrollable Limited Leverage, ULL, Part 2. For compound interest to be effective, you need three things. Number one, time, as measured in years. Number two, a favorable yearly investment yield within those years. And number three, an invested sum repeatedly invested. These three variables make up the latter portion of our slow lane wealth equation. Compound interest equals invested sum times 1 plus yield squared by time. Although this is a simplified version of a more complicated equation, the point of this analysis is its variable components. Compound interest demands that your investments yield a predictable 10% per year. Good luck with that 40-year gamble. Have the markets ever lost 20% in 1 year, or 40%? They have, and when they do, your hard-earned savings evaporate. You see, wealth acceleration via compound interest is deficient because its variables are deficient. Neither time nor yield can be leveraged or controlled. Again, meet my friend, uncontrollable limited leverage. Can you demand a 2,000% return on your money this year? Can you demand your investment time horizon increase from the standard 40 years to 400 years? Again, the numbers can't be leveraged. Your upper limit of time investment horizon is 50 years. Yield is worse. 6%, 8%, or 10% yearly investment returns are typical standards. Time is restrained by the years in your life, yield is restrained by the average yield of typical market investments, and sum is limited because your means of creating income comes from a job, also limited. The only way to subvert the mathematical weakness of compound interest is to start with a large number, and large numbers require leverage. Additionally, like a job, you can't control compound interest. Can you demand your bank pay you 25% interest on your savings? Hey, Mr. Slowland Bank, I demand a 25% yield on my savings account. Can you control the economy? Hey, Mr. Economy, can you guarantee me low unemployment and a business-friendly tax environment? Can you control the average yield of the stock market? Hey, Mr. Stock Market, I'm tired of these 8% returns. Can you give me 250% this year? Funny stuff. Can you control anything in this equation other than the furious, labor-intensive search for the best investments just to ensure you can eke out another marginal 1%? You can't. Why mutual funds and 401ks won't make you rich. In 2008, I went to a fixed income investment seminar given by a major brokerage house. Fixed income investments are instruments like municipal and corporate bonds. Approximately 50 people attended the standing room only seminar. I sat in the back and surveyed the crowd. Removed the gray hair, the socks and sandals combos, the canes, the wheelchairs, and what was left? Just me. I was the youngest person in the room, and heck, I'm not even that young anymore. How does a 30-something get in a room full of retirees? The people in the room were slow lane success stories. They used time to accelerate wealth, and what it got them was old age. I don't say that to be mean-spirited to older generations, but to cast a light on the point. Compound interest, 401ks, mutual funds, the stock market, cannot accelerate wealth fast. According to research and marketing firm The Harrison Group, only 10% of pentamillionaires, which is a net worth of $5 million or more, report that their wealth came from passive instruments. Age data was not provided, but you can guess none of the 10% were under 30. Think about it. Have you ever met a college student who got rich investing in mutual funds or because of his employer's 401k? How about the guy who bought municipal bonds in 2006 and retired in 2009? I wonder if that guy driving that $1.2 million supercar can because of his well-balanced portfolio of mutual funds. These people don't exist because the youthful rich are not leveraging 8% returns, but 800%. Has your wealth ever grown by 800% in 1 year? Probably not, but guess what? Mine has, because I'm not shackled to the slow lane wealth equation. My wealth acceleration vehicle doesn't come from the stock market. Yet, you've been domesticated to believe that these tools accelerate wealth. Mutual funds, stocks, bonds, 401ks, dollar cost averaging, and compound interest, these are all standard strategies for wealth acceleration in the slow lane. Unfortunately, without control or leverage, they're impotent wealth accelerators. Buy and hold is dead. In college, I was taught buy and hold was the safe investment strategy that made millions. Buy stocks and solid companies, sit back and wait decades, and voila, I'd be awash with millions. They'd shove that graph in your face and say, a $10,000 investment in XYZ company in 1955 would be worth $5 million today. Thankfully, I ignored it. In 1997, I opened a Roth IRA with $1,000 and invested the monies in a growth mutual fund at a major investment firm. Yes, I let the professionals manage it for me. For the next decade, I didn't touch it. Essentially, I forgot about the account. In the 10 years that followed, I made over $10 million by following a Fastlane roadmap and leveraging Fastlane strategy. And what about that Roth IRA I started years ago? I never touched it, and I let it ride the ebbs and flow of the slow lane. Today, that account is worth $698. With inflation, the real purchasing power is probably $500. My spare change bucket on my kitchen table was a better investment. Had I invested $1 million, I would have lost more than $400,000. And yet, this is the slow laner's anointed weapon of wealth. Hilarious. Millions worship the slow lane roadmap with buy and hold as Main Street, a Main Street that is decades long, imperiled by hazards, and rarely routes to wealth. I recently heard a slow lane prognosticator proclaim the effectiveness of get rich slow by citing this tasty factoid.
If at the end of 1940 you had invested $1,000 in the stocks of the S&P 500, you would now have $1.3 million.
So let's examine this fact, assuming it is fact. Number one, it's 1940 and assume you are 21 years old. Number two, it's 1940 and you somehow got your hands on $1,000, which in today's dollars is about $15,000. Number three, you took that $1,000 in 1940s money and invested it in the S&P as explained earlier. Congratulations, it is now 2011 and you are 91 years old, rich with $1.3 million. Or if you were lucky to get your $1,000 on birth, you'd now be 71 years old. Yes, folks, it's time to get excited. Get Rich Slow is going to make you rich. Just ignore your 74-year life expectancy and make sure your wheelchair comes equipped with chrome rims. Seriously, how does anyone get excited over this crap? The Slow Lane's traitorous relationship with time. Compound interest and a job have the same disease. The sinful and gluttonous consumption of your time while forsaking control. Both variables within the slow lane wealth equation are anchored by time. Time traded in a job and time traded in the markets. Time becomes the linchpin for wealth that ties the mathematical handicaps of mortality. 24 hours in a day and a 50-year work life expectancy. Yes, getting rich is a function of time. Unless you plan on living forever, this relationship is foolhardy. Why? Because to trade your time away is to trade your wealth away. Examine this example. If you had a salary for $75,000 a year, and you saved 5% of it for 40 years at 8%, you'd end up with more than $1 million. Don't get enamored with the number. Keep in mind, this is 40 years from now. If you're 20 years old, you will be 60 years old. If you're 30 years old, you will be 70 years old. If you're 40 years old, you'll likely be dead. Sorry, but that's beyond life expectancy. So at these ages, does this money and the freedom it buys sound appealing? Also, do you realize that this money will have 50% of today's buying power? 40 years ago, you could buy a car for $3,000 and a loaf of bread for 20 cents. Lest we not forget other lofty assumptions, gainful employment, and a robust economy that behests a safe 8% per year. In 2008, the markets lost 50%. I guess the gurus forgot to mention these anomalies. Folks, you don't want millions to accompany your cane. You want it to accompany your youth. Every day, people sacrifice their time for tiny nuggets of wealth where time is the liability and not the asset. Anything that steals time and doesn't have the power to free time is a liability. Within the slow lane, time is mistreated like an effervescent fountain that runs forever. Unfortunately, the mortality rate is 100%, and life's prognosis is death. Someday you will die, and hopefully 60% of your time wasn't squandered in a cubicle while your children grew up and your spouse cheated with the yoga instructor. The slow lane is a plan of hope. You're reading this book because you want to control your financial destiny, not put it in the hands of some company or the stock market. If you want to get rich, you have to control and leverage the variables in your financial plan. Any financial plan without control immediately disintegrates into a plan of hope. Hope I don't get laid off. Hope my stocks rebound. Hope I get that promotion. Hope my hours aren't cut. Hope my company doesn't go bankrupt. Hope, hope, and hope. Sorry, but hope is not a plan. The slow lane rests in a mathematical prison with time as the warden. To create explosive wealth fast, you must abandon the slow lane formula and its lecherous relationship to time. Wealth is built with time as an asset, not as a liability. Yet the slow laner's reaction to uncontrollable limited leverage is predictable. They embark on an errant fight against the one variable they perceive as controllable, their intrinsic value. The slow laner argues, I must make more money. And that fight is fought futilely with an expensive education. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. Slow lane wealth is improbable due to uncontrollable limited leverage. The first variable in the slow lane wealth equation evolves from a job that factors to intrinsic value that equates to your nominal value for each unit of time traded. Intrinsic value is the value of your time set by the marketplace and is measured in units of time, either hourly or yearly. In the slow lane, intrinsic value, regardless of its time measurement, is numerically inhibited because there are only 24 hours in a day for the hourly worker, and the average lifespan is 74 years for the salaried worker. Like the slow laner's primary income source, a job, the slow laner's wealth acceleration vehicle, compound interest, is also pegged to time. Like a job, compound interest is mathematically futile and cannot be manipulated. You cannot force feed the market or the economy to give you phenomenal returns year after year. Wealth cannot be accelerated when pegged to mathematics based on time. Time is your primordial fuel, and it should not be traded for money. Your time should not be an expendable resource for wealth, because wealth itself is composed of time. Your mortality makes time mathematically retarded for wealth creation. If you don't control the variables inherent in your wealth universe, you don't control your financial plan. Chapter 13, The Futile Fight, Education. The only thing that interferes with my learning is my education. Albert Einstein. The fight against uncontrollable limited leverage, education. The slow laner's natural reaction to uncontrollable limited leverage inherent in their wealth equation is to wage war with intrinsic value by deploying the education weapon. Since ULL defines the slow laner rationalizes that the only variable worthy of escalation is their rate of pay. I need to make six figures. I need to make more money. So predictably, they go back to school and get an MBA or some certification. They'll argue, MBA grads earn 15% more, or the starting salary of a certified PMP is $120,000 a year. For example, Steve Ambrose enrolls in an MBA program to sweeten his credentials. The cost of the MBA is $44,000 and 800 hours. Steve justifies this twofold expense, time and money, because he anticipates his intrinsic value will rise. Upon completion, Steve expects to be worth more to his company and worth more in the competitive marketplace. Unfortunately, he still trades his time for money, just at a higher rate, and yet still uncontrolled and unleveraged. Another example is my friend who enrolled in a project management certification class that ate 5 8-hour Saturdays from her life and cost $2,700. Her goal? A project management credential that would raise her intrinsic value in the marketplace. As a certified project manager, she exposes herself to new opportunities at higher grades of pay, but still a trade of time for money. Whether consciously or not, the slow laner believes that elevating intrinsic value can create wealth. Want to be highly paid right out of college? Go to medical school and become a doctor. As a physician, your intrinsic value is now worth $200 per hour. Become an engineer, a lawyer, or an accountant. All highly paid, professional, salaried positions. Typically, a formal college education is used to serve slow lane purposes, an explicit attempt to raise intrinsic value. Not all education is created equal. The problem with formal education used to raise intrinsic value is that it's ungodly expensive in time and money. Not a week goes by when I don't hear about some freshly minted MBA grad who struggles to pay his student loans while working a mid-grade job he could have gotten right out of high school. Debt that traps you to a job is not good debt. A preoccupation to become highly educated could be a Trojan horse to your freedom. Not all education is created equal. Some education can roadblock your wealth road trip. If an education entombs you under a mountain of debt and shackles you to a job for the rest of your life, was it really a good education? If an MBA increases your salary by 15%, but takes you 15 years to pay, was it a good investment? It's a great myth. To get rich, you need an expensive college degree. Hogwash. A degree isn't a prerequisite to fast lane wealth. Some of the richest fastlaners are people who never either finished high school or college. Bill Gates, Steven Spielberg, Richard Branson, Michael Dell, Felix Dennis, David Geffen, and John Paul DeJoria all dropped out of school to pursue fastlane objectives. How dare they get rich and not be educated? Slow lane entrapment. Financing expensive college tuition for an education is a dangerous game that can lead to slow lane entrapment, conformity, and education servitude. A typical collegiate study progresses from general knowledge to very specific skill sets. For example, while studying finance, I learned complex mathematical formulas that aided in financial decision making, things like lease or buy or return on investment. These concepts are specific tools to a trade that can hinder your future options. The prescribed path for graduates with finance degrees was to get a job in a financial sector, an insurance company, an accounting firm, or an investment house. My education had the indirect and unintended consequence of restricting my options to specific disciplines based on an educative skill set. The result? Conformity and limited choice. If there aren't opportunities in my field, my education becomes marginalized and devalued. If the opportunities available require less education, say a BS and I have an MBA, I become overqualified and unemployable. If my skills erode in practicality based on technological evolution, my education becomes deprecated and my value to society plummets accordingly. The second educational entrapment danger is education servitude. While the sidewalker deals with lifestyle servitude, the slow laner wrestles with education servitude, which is freedom eroded by education that traps the victim to a job. Has your education indentured you to a job? Advanced degrees are not cheap. According to the College Board, the average college degree, including room and board, now costs nearly $60,000. Prefer the prestige of a private school? The tab will set you back a Ferrari. This kind of debt buries the dreams of our youth and puts them permanently bound to the slow lane, or worse, the sidewalk. Consider the statistics. In 2007, the Washington Post reported that, according to Nellie Mae, the big student loan service provider, by the time college students are seniors, 56% of them will have four or more credit cards with an average balance of $2,800. According to a research report by Demos, a public policy research and advocacy organization, people in the 18 to 24 age bracket spend nearly 30% of their monthly income on debt repayment. This is double from 20 years ago. A survey of college borrowers found that the average college senior graduated with nearly $19,000 in student loan debts, and graduate degree pursuers more than $45,000. A 2007 Charles Schwab survey revealed that teenagers believe that when they get older, they will earn an average salary of $145,000. The reality? Adults with a college degree earned an average of $54,000. Unfortunately, the future isn't so bright that you have to wear shades. The truth behind the reality and expectation is about a $100,000 chasm. This disparity might explain why the debts of our youth have exploded as they bridge their reality to expectation. Hell, if I can't make $145,000, I can make it look like I make $145,000. The best excuse people have for not having wealth is, I don't have time. Well, why don't you have time? Well, because you have a job. Why do you have a job? Because you need one. Why do you need one? Because you have bills to pay. Why do you have bills to pay? Because you have debt. Well, why do you have debt? Oh, yes, because you went to school for 6 years and have six figures in student loans. If you financed your advanced education with debt, the debt automatically becomes parasitic and traps you into forced job servitude, and that destroys freedom. While you might earn more, work is forced to stave off the debt. The debt is parasitic because it fails to free time and instead creates indentured time. Sadly, the parasitic debt is unforgiving and it isn't sympathetic to the source. Whether you owe $35,000 for your awesome BMW or for student loans, debt steals freedom and forces indentured time. Chapter Summary, Fastlane Distinctions. Slowlaners attempt to manipulate intrinsic value by education. Indentured time is the time you spend earning a living. It is the opposite of free time. Parasitic debt is debt that creates indentured time and forces work. Chapter 14, The Hypocrisy of the Gurus. There was a time when a fool and his money were soon parted, but now it happens to everybody. Adlai Stevenson. You've been duped. Suppose after college you're getting a bit pudgy around the middle and decide it's time to get back into shape. You enroll in a community college class called Healthy Nutrition, Eat Your Way to a Beautiful Body. On the first day of class, you arrive early, seat yourself, and anxiously await the class instructor. After a few minutes, an obese man walks into the room and waddles to the front of the class. You think, wow, he's fat, but he's here to change that, so good for him. As the man profusely sweats while fumbling with a stack of papers, you glance at the student chair next to the man and wonder, can he fit on it? He's twice the size of the chair. Then suddenly, you're hit with the paradox. This isn't a student, but the instructor. Are you freaking kidding me? How could this man effectively teach a class called Healthy Nutrition, Eat Your Way to a Beautiful Body, when he is not a model of his teaching? How can anyone take him seriously? Bewildered at the hypocrisy, you leave class and head to the bursar's office, intent on getting a tuition refund. When it comes to gurus and financial advisors, this is what you must do. You must leave class and request a refund because they're guilty of a paradox of practice. The paradox of practice. The paradox of practice asks, do you practice what you preach? Are you a model and an exemplification of what you teach? For example, would you take skincare advice from a butterface? Would you take financial advice from a bankrupt bum? Would you take medical advice from a sanitation worker? Would you take bodybuilding advice from a 90-pound weakling? The paradox of practice is a heated debate in my forum. Some people feel it's perfectly acceptable to preach a strategy for wealth and yet never use it. Do as I say, not as I do. A paradox of practice exists when someone promotes a money-making strategy, but that strategy is not what made him rich. In other words, they're not practitioners of their own advice. These people effectively teach one wealth equation, the slow lane, why they get rich leveraging another, the fast lane. When I see financial powerhouse Susie instructing people to dollar-cost average their mutual fund portfolios, do I listen to her? Hell no. I laugh. When Kramer advocates stock in Lehman Brothers because he says it's a good buy, do I listen? No way. I feel sorry for anyone who follows the investment advice of these people. I consider these people to be better entertainers than investment advisors. I have no love lost for the poor sap who lost his retirement savings because he listened to some CNBC pundit peddling some hot stock tip or investment advice. What is wrong with people? How do you not take responsibility for your financial plan? And then, of course, there's your uncle. You know the guy, the well-educated elder in your life who knows everything, including the molecular structure of dark matter in the Horsehead Nebula. His army of factoids is always ready for deployment. Stock tips, the latest and greatest investments, money trends, and of course, lest you forget, he lives paycheck to paycheck. I call these people broke know-it-alls, people who dispense financial money-making advice, and yet they're dirt poor. These fat behemoths are walking hypocrisies on how to live a life of health and fitness. Folks, listen to these people with an entertainment expectation, not advice. Good advice comes from the guy who scores all the touchdowns, not the guy shut out in the fourth quarter. Yes, the best quarterbacking advice comes from Peyton Manning, not MJ DeMarco. Is the paradox of practice in play? In the game of money, money is the scorecard. If someone tells you how they scored, make sure they disclose the real method to wealth, not the illusion concealing the real culprit. Sadly, it's virtually impossible to get good, practical money advice because most gurus live a paradox of practice. Yes, gurus are rarely rich because of their advice, but rich because they're successful fastlaners who covertly hide their paradox of practice. These paradoxical metaphors described earlier befit the hypocrisy of the people who you've entrusted with your financial roadmap. You're sold blindly down the river by a ride they've never completed. Meanwhile, they gaze at you comfortably above in their corporate jet drinking champagne. No one tells you the real, unadulterated story behind their road to wealth, but I will. The slow lane roadmap is sanctimoniously trumpeted by best-selling book authors who dispense financial advice through TV, radio, and books. The strategies they sell are a travesty of grand illusions. Do you seriously think that these people are rich from their preachings, or are they selling you the slow lane while they get rich in the fast lane? Let me hypothesize about the probable wizardry behind their charade. First, we have Susie. Susie preaches mutual funds, dollar cost averaging, and 401ks. We can absorb Susie in many media, radio, TV, and in any of her half dozen books. Her grill is everywhere. She's the wretched slow lane poster child, a high volume producer of slow lane junkets spewed to millions. So what's the problem? Well, ask yourself this. Is Susie rich because she followed her own advice, like municipal bonds, dollar cost averaging, and 401ks? The probable hypocrisy, the paradox of practice, is that Susie's method of creating wealth doesn't appear to be the road she travels, nor teaches. Is Susie Fastlane rich because she leverages the Fastlane roadmap while she pitches you the slow lane? In other words, is she worth millions because she followed her own advice, or because she sold millions of books? Is her wealth equation different from the one she teaches? These are the things that will make you go, hmm. In a 2007 article, Susie was quoted as admitting to having the bulk of her wealth, an estimated $25 million, in bonds, primarily municipals. Additionally, she admits that only 4% of her wealth is tied up in the stock market because, personally, if I lose $1 million, I don't care. Wow, and yet this is the vehicle you should entrust to build your wealth? How exactly did Miss Susie acquire that $25 million nest egg? Because of her advice, which champions the stock market, mutual funds, IRAs, bonds, and treasuries? Or did she use the Fastlane roadmap, amass wealth fast by explosive net income, and then pour her wealth into these instruments? Yet her advice for the people at the precipice of poverty is that they should invest in the stock market to create wealth, when it appears like she hasn't. Folks, the rich are using the markets for income and wealth preservation, not to create it. Then we have David. As I thumbed through David's many books, I was inundated with an alarming quantity of slow lane ilk. Compound interest tables, save 10% of your paycheck, stop drinking expensive coffee, and other chronic slow lane diatribes. Again, the paradox of practice rears its ugly mug. Did David get rich from his advice? Or from selling 11 books, over and over several million times, often regurgitating the same slow lane sludge until you can't take it anymore? And finally, we have Robert. Robert, who hails from Hawaii and has two dads, one rich, one poor. Double Dad Robert bellicosely explains the real definition of assets and that sophisticated investors are deep into real estate. On national television, Robert once bragged about his Lamborghini, and I found this extravagant exposition ironic, yet disingenuous. Well, why? Isn't Robert showcasing the fruit of his teachings? Perhaps. You see, Robert is a fast lane success story. He created and built a brand worth millions. But the curious question is this. Which came first? The best-selling book or the Lamborghini? Is there a paradox of practice underneath? Did Robert have the status icon pre-book by leveraging his real estate teachings? Or did the Lamborghini arrive after selling millions of books? Robert undoubtedly has amassed a great deal of wealth selling books, games, and seminars. And yet, is it possible you're being sold one wealth equation while the architect of the game uses another? Gurus fill a market need, and I don't deny it. However, consider this. Are they being truthful about their paradox and their magic potion? Are they rich because of what they preach or what they sell? Once you're familiar with fast lane mathematics, it should become clear to you which gurus are likely guilty of the paradox. Is the underlying mathematical equation which governs their teachings the same one that made them rich? If the do as I say doesn't match the do as I do, you should be suspicious. What makes me different is this. The fast lane concepts in this book gave me financial independence. I already have financial freedom, the nice house, the sports car, the flashy rapper credit card. I don't need this book to get me these things. I also confess this fast lane disclaimer. This book has the power to make me wealthier because it leverages the same wealth equation that I teach you. In other words, my do as I say matches the do as I do. Slow lane gurus admit failure. On a slow lane financial radio show, a caller sought advice. In a few months, the recession destroyed more than 50% of her savings, which it had taken her nearly 10 years to accumulate. The slow lane guru's advice? A palliative, stick to the plan, recommit, rebuild. In other words, my crappy plan has failed you, has taken 11 years to fail you, and yet you need to stand by it. Hope the economy rebounds. Hope the economy never sees another recession. Hope, hope, and hope. And yes, please buy my newest book, Rebuild. Economic recessions expose the slow lane as a risky fraud with lifetime ramifications. Since these gurus make their rich livelihood selling the slow lane roadmap, they need you to believe it works. Their wealth comes from your belief. Despite the current recession's masterful exposé, the slow lane Illuminati will never admit that their strategy is woefully inept, and instead they have deviously recalibrated their message to conceal the truth. They continue to spew the same failed rhetoric by writing new books with new titles and new platitudes. Titles like Rebuild Your Wealth, or Start Over, or Recommit. Notice the shift in language exposing the truth. If the plan is so good, why do you need to rebuild or start over? If the strategy worked, such words wouldn't be necessary. For the charade to continue, the gurus need to reinforce the strategy with new books selling the same old shit. And of course, the bigger question is, do you think the gurus need to start over or rebuild? Of course not. They don't use the plan that they sell. They operate in an entirely different wealth universe, which is not predicated on uncontrollable, limited leverage. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. Take advice from people with a proven, successful track record of their espoused discipline. Many money gurus often suffer from a paradox of practice. They teach one wealth equation while getting rich in another. They're not rich from their own teachings. Chapter 15,